Good afternoon. So last time we talked about locks along with how processors in a multi-core system actually share the memory. We talked about this notion of our simplest way of connecting processors, multiple processors to a memory, was the shared bus. And that gave us a way to keep caches in sync because we want to have each processor have fast local copies of data, but we don't want to not be able to reason about what happens when two processors are trying to access the same data, like, and they might both have cache. We learned that, unfortunately, it is a little tricky to figure out what goes on by default because we have this reordering of loads and stores. And there's the culprit of the processor actually does this itself. It, unless you tell it not to, decides, okay, I'm gonna do this load a little early, and this can result in results which don't make any sense. But we do have this hardware mechanism for keeping the processors in sync about what's in the cache. And we talked about one protocol for this where the processors would agree to keep track of this modified, shared, or invalid state for each thing they had in their cache, and only one processor would modify a value at a time. So we never would have issues with what is the most recent version of the value in memory. And we mentioned that, well, even though ordinarily the processor and compilers would take lots of shortcuts and say, well, I can load this value earlier, that's gonna be faster. We had ways of turning that off. We had some atomic instructions as they're known, so we ways of doing what was called a fence to force reordering not to happen, to make sure all the loads actually happen before we do something else, for example. And we had these atomic read, modify, write instructions, which read a value, modify it, and then write it back, which could be implemented in cache coherency by keeping the value in the cache in the modified state. And those are mechanisms that let us build up ways of actually keeping two different cores in sync, actually having two threads communicate with each other in an intelligent way. And we had one way of doing this, the simplest possible implementation of our lock idea, was a spin lock. The way a spin lock worked is we set this value conditionally with an atomic read, modify, write instruction, and based on whether that was actually meant that we were the one setting it, we said required lock if we set it from taken to taken from not taken, and otherwise we learned that someone else had the lock, and because it was an atomic instruction, we knew that only one core would think it was the one which got the lock. Now, spin locks had this big problem that when we're waiting for the lock, the only way we have of waiting is just this loop where we keep saying, can I take the lock now? And try to get it. Can I get the lock now? And try to get it. And this means that while someone else is holding the lock for a while, we're just going to use all the CPU time we can, and that seems awfully inefficient. We'd like other things to run. We know that the scheduler might have some other programs, other threads, that could use the CPU and probably a lot more efficiently than just checking something which is not going to change for a while. And we have this higher level lock abstraction known as mutexes, which would solve this problem. And the way mutexes would solve this problem is that rather than having someone waiting for the lock, keep checking over and over again, is the lock available, is the lock available, is the lock available, until it was, they would put themselves on a list to be notified later. Now, we still needed a way of coordinating that list. We can't just modify something from two different processors and expect it to work. So we need some way of making sure only one processor at a time deals with that list. And the mechanism for that would be a spin lock. So we'd use these crappy locks to implement our good locks. And our sort of high-level view of that is this is what our mutex has. We have our spin lock, our lock that's going to do this busy waiting, this very slow, is the lock taken, is the lock taken, but we're only going to use it to manage things in the mutex data structure. When the mutex is locked, typically we won't actually be using the spin lock. And so this is going to be efficient. And the mutex is going to track whether the lock's taken, and if it, you know, if it is taken, possibly a list of processes that want to get it but can't now. And our rule is that we're going to acquire this guard spin lock before we touch anything else in the mutex structure. So we're only going to ever manipulate the lock taken flag or the wait queue flag, including even just reading it, after acquiring the guard spin lock. And this is going to ensure that no one is confused about whether the lock is really taken or not, or whether someone is on the wait queue or was removed from the wait queue, because the only time we check that, the only time we change that, is when only one processor is doing that at a time. So the important data structure here we need is we have this queue of waiting threads, and all the threads in this queue are not runnable. So we have our lock and unlock functions given this. So for our lock function, we first get the spin lock, because we have to have the spin lock before we touch anything that's a part of the mutex struct besides the spin lock itself. And then we check, is the lock already taken? And if it's not, we actually have our easiest case. So if the lock isn't taken, we just go to this else, which is set the lock as taken, unlock the spin lock. That's all we do. So in the simple case, no one needs to wait. We just get the spin lock, set a flag, release the spin lock. Then we have our tricky case where, well, someone else already got the lock, so the lock is taken. And I don't want to just keep checking, is the lock taken, is the lock taken, is the lock taken. So what I'm going to do instead is I'm going to add myself to the wait queue. And in doing this, I'm saying I'm relying on whoever unlocks this lock is going to look at that wait queue. They're not just going to set lock taken to false. They're going to look at the wait queue and make sure I know about it. So I put myself on the wait queue, and I mark myself as not runnable. And then I unlock the spin lock and go to the scheduler so the scheduler can actually switch to another thread. Notice that I marked myself as not runnable while I had the spin lock. And this makes sure that if someone takes me off the queue and sets me as runnable, that they do so without me overwriting that with I'm not runnable. If I set myself as runnable without the spin lock, then maybe someone could have, you know, in this little piece of time, marked me as runnable again, and then I set myself as not runnable and negate that. So I'm changing whether I'm runnable with the spin lock held to ensure that if someone takes me off the queue and marks me as runnable, that that's actually the last thing which happens, that I don't mark myself as not runnable earlier, or later than that. Okay, and then we have our unlock operation. So our unlock operation, we lock the spin lock, and in the easy case, our queue is empty. That no one was waiting. In that case, we just set the lock taken flag to false and move on. Our tricky case is someone else tried to get the lock and they couldn't, so the queue isn't empty. So in that case, we remove a thread from the wait queue and mark it as runnable. That's it. You might say, maybe we should run the scheduler and run the thread immediately. That is a thing we could do. It is not necessary for the lock to work. In this case, if I just mark it as runnable and make sure, as long as the scheduler is on the list of the things the scheduler looks at, that's enough. And I don't have to worry about when exactly it runs. Yeah?
And why don't we have to set the lock taken to false either way?
So the question is, why don't we set the lock taken to false in this piece of code? We set it here. So why don't we do it here? That's okay to do because we're going to start this other thread. So what's going to happen is some thread which was here is going to start running here, and it wants lock taken to be true when it returns anyways, so we're just not manipulating it at all. One way you can think about this is that we're handing the lock from one thread to another without unlocking it. And that's why I skipped setting the lock taken to false. Okay. Other questions? And yes, and I have this slide. decrementing that to 2. We take out two other copies, we call down 2 more times, decrementing that to 0. And this all happens without any weighting, because we started out as non-negative. Then, if I try to reserve a book, I call down again, but down doesn't let it become negative, it just waits. So we start waiting until someone returns a copy and releases that waiter, and we're done waiting, and the free number of free copies stays at 0. Because we waited for the down to finish until the up happened, and they just cancel each other out. So this is general pattern. And one way of thinking about semaphores is like tracking the number of free things. So the count of the semaphore is thinking how much is free, down is reserve a thing, up is release a thing. So this is one way we can view semaphores. So this makes it easy to show that semaphores are more general than mutexes. So if we think of a mutex is a lock, one thing that is sometimes free and sometimes not. So a mutex is a semaphore with a value of 1. For locking it, we do down, we decrement the number of free things from 1 to 0, or if it's 0, we wait until it's free. And to unlock it, we increment the number of free things from 0 to 1. So questions? Far. Okay, but semaphores are a lot more flexible. So one example is if we think of join, like that pthread join operation, we can implement that very easily with a semaphore. So here I have a semaphore and I say that we have 2 possible states. So initially it's going to be 0. And when it's 0, that means either we're in the initial state that the thread we're joining hasn't finished, and we haven't started waiting for it, or we're in the state 1 is the thread finished, and 0 is the thread is already joined. So the logic here is that we call down to start waiting for the thread to finish, and we call up to signal that the thread is finished. So this is a way where our exit operation is saying, hey, my return value is available now. There's 1 return value available. And the down operation you can think of as reserve the return value of this thread I'm joining. And this implements that operation here. So initially it's 0, meaning nothing, the thread is not available to be finished. We call down to reserve the thread being done, and the thread calls up when it's actually done. You can take that being doneness from it. Okay, so questions on here? And there's this general pattern where I have explicitly written down what the meaning of each of the values of the semaphore is. This is how I like thinking about how do I use semaphores to do something, is I want to know what does the value mean? And we'll talk about that a bit more later. And that's how I reason about, does the down operation make sense? Does the up operation make sense? So here we say the up operation going from the initial state is saying we're finished. The down operation is saying is like trying to get us to go from finish to the initial state. And if it can't do that, it's going to wait. Okay. So POSIX has semaphores in the semaphore.h header. And yes, this is not consistent with what you've seen earlier, like not everything starts with pthread. It's just how it works. And it has an init operation, which takes the semaphore via a pointer, the initial value of the semaphore, and this flag indicating whether the semaphore might be shared between 2 processes. In order to do that, 2 processes have to have pointers to the same memory, which we haven't discussed how to do, So probably you'll use zero, but it's a supported feature. It's part of the init call. Then there's wait for down and post for up, and there's also a destroy. Okay, any questions? Here, yes. Yes. They could be used to implement barriers. I don't actually have slides on that. The textbook has a description of this. So for implementing barriers, if you only wanted to use the barrier once, it's very straightforward. You start the semaphore. I guess it's not super straightforward, but it's relatively straightforward if you only want to wait once. If you want to wait multiple times, there's multiple strategies and gets a little tricky. The question is the process shared treated as a Boolean? Yes. And generally, we won't care about it. It turns out that on many OSs, including Linux, you need to do slightly different things if you're using something in shared memory between processes for synchronization. Okay. So, talking about the API for semaphores, but and I've given you these examples of like reserving books or implementing mutexes or implementing join, but we'd like to be able to construct examples of new semaphore operations. And it's not clear like how do you go from the semaphore tool to actually doing what we want. And the way I like thinking about it is I think of what do I need to wait for? Do I need to wait for the critical section to be finished for a mutex, for a queue to be not empty, for example, for an array to have space for items. And I want to think of something I can count that will be zero when I need to wait. So for the mutex, I can say the semaphore is counting how many threads can start a critical section now. The answer is initially zero. So the initial is initially one thread can do it. And when a thread's in a critical section, zero can start now. And when it's done, one can start. And then we can think of our down and up operations are just indicating when that changes. We call down when we're in a critical section, so another thread can't start it. We call up when we're done. For joining, we can think of it as representing the number of threads that can join without waiting. Initially, none can because it has to wait. And when we start joining, when we're done with the execution of the thread, one can join without waiting, so we increment it. And when we join, only one thread can join, so we decrement it. And I have some other options here, which we'll talk about next, of if you want to wait for a queue to be not empty, well, we're counting the number of items in the queue. When it's not zero, we don't want to wait. When it is zero, we do. And presumably we're waiting because we're going to take something off the queue anyways, so the down operation will be what we want. And for an array to have space for new items, we're going to think of the number of empty spaces in the array is what we're counting. Presumably if we're waiting for empty space, we're going to use one of those empty spaces, so the down operation is going to be what we want to do to reserve a space, and the up operation is going to be what we want to do when we free up a space. Okay, so questions on these examples? Okay, and we're going to use the intuition for these last two. We're going to go through an example of implementing what's known as the producer-consumer pattern. And this is something which comes up a lot in real code, which is that I have a producer, some thread which is producing values, or maybe multiple threads that are producing values. And I have a buffer, a queue, that some thread that's consuming values, or maybe more than one thread that's consuming values, is going to take things off that buffer, that queue, and remove values and process them. This is a comp pattern which comes up all the time. It's also the key pattern for the second threading homework. And the key idea of this is that we don't want the producer and consumer to work in lockstep. We don't want to do the barrier thing and say, We produce an item, consume an item. We want the producers to work as fast as they can, as long as we don't run out of buffer space. And the consumers to work as fast as they can, as long as there's still, as long as there's still items for them to process. And this is a really common pattern, even in cases which aren't so obvious. So one example is like a C compiler. We have the preprocessor, the compiler, the assembler, and the linker, and we kind of have this pattern there. And we'd like to like send values from one to the other. Like, this comes up all over the place. And if we want to use multiple cores for this, maybe we want to preprocess one file while we're compiling some others. We want to do it as fast as those steps go. So any questions about this problem? We're going to use this problem a lot, including with not just semaphores. Okay. So the big things we want to do with this model is that we have some cases where we need to wait. Remember, that's for our semaphores. What we're going to be concerned about is, when do we need to wait? We want something which is zero when we do. And we want the consumer to wait for the producer when the buffer is empty. If the buffer is empty, we don't want to just say there's a value in the buffer, and we don't want to keep checking, is the buffer empty? Is the buffer have a value? Does the buffer have a value? We want to just go to sleep, schedule something else, maybe the producer itself, until the buffer becomes non-empty. And the producer, if the buffer is full, we want to stop, not produce more values, and wait until the consumers catch up. We don't want them, you don't want to have to use infinite memory to store all the values we produced because the consumers are too slow. And we also have the second constraint, that the third constraint rather, that we have a shared buffer and we need to keep track of what things are in the buffer, what's its size. Like, we're gonna have like maybe a size variable or like linked list pointers. We don't want to get confused about what's in the buffer. We don't want two things trying to write to the buffer at the same time. So the simplest solution is that we're just gonna say no thread touches the buffer while another thread is. That when a thread is actually manipulating the buffer, we're not gonna let any other thread do it. You might say, could we do better than this? And the answer is yes, but then we have to talk about what happens inside the buffer. Like, is it a linked list? Is it something else? And we're not going to do that for now. So given these constraints, to use semaphores, I'm going to set up one semaphore for each of these cases we need to wait in. And this is going to be sort of my systematic pattern, is everything I need to wait for, we're going to have a different semaphore for that condition that we need to wait for. So I have a semaphore for waiting if the thing is empty, and this is going to count the number of full slots in my buffer. Because when that number is zero, I want to wait. I'm going to have something for the producer to wait when the buffer is full, so I'm going to count the number of empty slots. When there's no empty slots, I want to wait. And we're going to have a semaphore that implements a mutex, which is going to be for waiting when anyone is touching the buffer versus not. And I'm going to have my buffer. In this case, it's some fixed size queue, which I don't care how it's implemented. I just have someone's implementation. And because I'm ensuring only one thread accesses at a time, I don't need to worry about, does that buffer do locking inside itself or anything? Because I'm doing all the locking it needs. Okay, so questions on this setup here? So then our code looks something like this. So first, I have those semaphores, and I need to set them up with the initial values. So I have my count of the number of buffer slots used. Hopefully, my buffer is initially empty, so I set that to 0. And I have the count of the number of buffer slots free, and I set that to my arbitrary capacity of my fixed size queue. And I have my mutex. And remember, my mutex, the way we implemented it, I'm counting the number of threads which can start a critical section. Initially, that's 1. So my produce operation I wait for a free slot and reserve it. So remember the down operation when we're talking about books was reserving a book. So we're reserving a slot in a buffer. Then once I've reserved a slot, I actually acquire the mutex, so I'm the only one accessing the buffer, enqueue my item, release that so someone else can access the buffer again. And then I say, hey, I used a slot, so now it's available, possibly waking up a consumer who might want that, might want to reserve that for it to use to get something from the buffer. So any questions about that producer pattern? Okay. So in the consumer, I'm going to reserve an item that was previously produced by waiting on the full slots count, so decrementing the number of full available items. And once I've done that, I'm going to make sure I'm the only one touching the buffer to queue an item, let someone else use the buffer, and then say, I'm done with the item I just reserved off the buffer. You can produce onto it again by posting on the empty slots. That you're doing the up operation on the empty slots semaphore. Okay. So, and this is our synchronization code, and these waits will ensure that when the buffer is full, the producer will be waiting for an empty slot here. When the buffer is empty, the consumer will be waiting for a full slot here. And we have our proper non-busy waiting, just thread goes to sleep until it's signaled with a post to wake up behavior. And our mutex makes sure that even if our buffer, like if we try to enqueue two things at once, it would like right to the same place. We're not going to do that. We're going to do it one at a time. Okay, so one question is I reserved a slot, then acquired this mutex that controls access to the buffer. Could I do it the other way around? Yeah. So yeah, so you're saying it's you think that if I do this, there I might wait forever for a spot to empty up here. And yes, that can happen. So the problem is if I do this, I'm saying no one else can access the buffer, and then I'm waiting for a slot to empty up. So then what happens is someone's going to empty up the slot for me by consuming an item. So they're going to they're going to be waiting for me to free up an item and right, have the, yeah. So someone's going to be waiting on this mutex here to free up my item. And the subtlety is that they've, you know, taken one of the full slots. They're about to free up the slot for me, but I just grab the mutex they want. So I grab the buffer while I'm waiting. So the problem here is I'm saying only I can use the buffer while I'm waiting. That's not what we want to do. We want to say, you don't want to keep anyone else from using the buffer except when we're not gonna wait, because otherwise that's going to be a problem. And this is a problem called deadlock, which we'll talk about a lot next week, or possibly 2 weeks. And right, I have actual slides for this so I don't get confused. So the consumer reserves a slot from the that was previously produced, and it's going to, and this should be empty slots. We're gonna free up a slot. And we're gonna be waiting here and waiting here in both the threads, and nothing will happen. Okay, so that's something to note, that the order here matters, And I did things deliberately, so I when I'm holding the buffer, I'm not doing it anytime I might be waiting, so I know I'm never gonna hold the buffer for an arbitrarily long amount of time. But I might be waiting for someone to call produce or consume for an arbitrary amount of time, just because maybe there's not enough producers or consumers. How about the other way around? So we have the post at the end. It turns out those we can reorder because it doesn't matter. We're just waking people up, we're never waiting. So we can do those in either order, it will have the same effects. I would probably do it in this order, but it's not wrong to do it in the other order because post never waits for anything. It just possibly signals some people. So this is the pattern we had. So we had this counting empty slots, counting full slots to produce. We reserve an empty slot, so we decrement the number of empty slots. Then when we filled that slot, we increment the number of full slots. And between the time, those numbers disagree because we're writing a slot, it's neither empty or full yet, because we're not done. And consumer is the other way around. And I typically only thought about we have one producer, one consumer, but this works if we have 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. The same code works, so we've just handled as many threads as we want, producing values onto a queue, and as many threads as we want, reading those and processing them. Okay, so questions about this works? So that's an example of using semaphores, and you can see from this example why semaphores seem like a really attractive mechanism, because this is a real pattern that comes up all the time, and the implementation with semaphores is pretty straightforward and really flexible. And the semaphores I've told you have this count. So these are actually known as counting semaphores. And there's another type of semaphores that commonly you might see called binary semaphores. And these are semaphores which are only ever 0 or 1, where if you try to up them multiple times, it's an error. That if you ever make the count go above 1, that you're not allowed to do that. And you might say, these seem not very useful. Maybe they're easier to implement, but they're not very useful. But it turns out they're exactly as powerful as normal semaphores. And the reason why is that with multiple binary semaphores, you can exactly simulate, and some variables, you can simulate a counting semaphore, so they can do all the same stuff. So an example of this is that assuming we have a positive initial value, I'm gonna have a mutex and a gate semaphore. And I'm gonna use these two semaphores and a counter to implement a counting semaphore. So my down operation is I use the mutex to make sure no one else is changing the value, my counter. I decrement the count, and I check the condition of, did I get down to 0? Do I need to wait? Using this gate. And I think I have this code in the wrong place. Yeah. This code part should be here because I apparently do not check these slides. Did not use these slides last semester. So the idea that if the value is 0, I wait, and then I decrement the value after it's not 0. I put this code in the I have an off by one fence post error that should be here. So if the value is 0, then I wait. I'll correct this slide later. And I call down on the gate. Yeah.
Isn't that already correct though?
Already?
I'm confused because if the semaphore is already at 0, and you go into the if statement after the if statement, includes, then you're decrementing to negative value?
The idea is that this gate would keep us from doing that. Except that this should be zero in that case. This is what I meant, I think. Okay, yeah. So this gate should be zero, and this should be afterwards. I do not know how I made so many errors on this and didn't notice last semester. This is why I assume I didn't need to carefully proofread this, but I guess I didn't touch this slide last semester. So the idea is that if the value is zero, we don't want to decrement it to a negative number, which is just an, instead, we're going to call down on this gate, this single binary semaphore, waiting for someone to increment the value back up to from zero. I think I just had a fence post error here. So yeah, from zero to one and signal that gate. And that's our, so. And this only happens when we go from zero to one, so we don't have to worry about violating the semaphore property. So we're not gonna, yeah, so I will, yeah. I'll double check this code sometime, probably on Friday. Sure. So that's just, we're not gonna use binary semaphores much. I mostly want you to know that this is something you might see. And in fact, I promise there's a way of doing everything you can do with counting semaphores with binary semaphores, just with more of them. I prefer counting semaphores because they're more straightforward for some things, but we can use that gate strategy of check for a condition that should wake one thread up and use that single gate for each thread. And we can just have lots of semaphores to handle that. So for every thread you want to wake up, you just have one binary semaphore, and you can do wake up whatever thread you want whenever you want. So it turns out you can implement them. So, since we're talking about semaphores, Anders and Dahlin don't like semaphores. Our view is that programming with locks and condition variables is superior to programming with semaphores. So they like this other thing called locks and condition variables. And there's two arguments they have. So one, it is clearer to have separate constructs for waiting for a condition to come true from allowing a thread to manipulate one thing at a time. They don't like that semaphores both handle the signaling someone that like there's empty space in our buffer, and the mutual exclusion are sort of put together. They don't like that. The other thing they don't like is that you have to be very careful that you call up exactly once for every down for with a semaphore. If you don't do that, if you be any sloppy about that, like your count's wrong, you do that, we're going to have alternatives where we don't need to be so careful, and locks and condition variables are going to let us do that. So that's our next topic is going to be monitors, which are locks and condition variables, or mutexes and condition variables, which are another alternative to semaphores, which, like semaphores, will allow us to do all sorts of synchronization operations, pretty much anything you want to do, where sometimes threads go to sleep and wake up when you choose. But they're going to have a different interface, which, as this previews, is going to have a separate idea of what it means to wait for a condition to become true from enforcing that one thread does thing a set of time. So these are going to be called monitors as a common name for locks and condition variables put together. So we're going to use locks, our same mutex as we saw before, for mutual exclusion, but we're going to have this separate object called a condition variable, which is a really deceptive name because you won't call what this is doing a variable, really. But I'm sorry, that's the name that everyone uses, that the original thing used. And the condition variables represent waiting for an event. And the idea is that a monitor is the combination of a lock, a condition variable, and the data structures that the lock protects. So in the case of our producer-consumer, the buffer. Like altogether would be called a monitor when we're implementing our producer-consumer with condition variables and locks, that we have a lock, a condition, several condition variables, and the buffer together are the monitor and has some set of operations. And this, in fact, is the you know, a scheme that is common in object-oriented languages. So in Java, it turns out every object is a monitor. So in Java, every object has some data. It's instance variables. That's obvious. It also has a built-in lock and a built-in condition variable. So every object in Java has a lock and a condition variable. It turns out, you probably haven't used it, but it's there on every single object. And the idea is to support the pattern we'll be showing later. In pthreads, we're not going to have that object-oriented style. Pthreads is a C API. So we have locks, which we've seen already, pthread mutex t. And we have the separate condition variable object, which I'll show you the API for probably next time. So let's go through our basic sort of idea of what monitors look like. So here's our monitor. We have some operations on this shared data. And we have a lock to protect access to that data. And we have some condition variables to represent things we're waiting on. So our lock is, our rule is going to be we access the lock before we touch any of the shared data or any of the condition variables. And because of that, our lock has a queue. We saw our mutex implementation. There's a queue of threads waiting for the lock. Our condition variables are going to be additional queues. That's essentially what they represent, is additional queues of threads. But they're not waiting for the lock. They're waiting for something else to happen. Like they're waiting for there to be an item for them to read from the buffer. And these are queues that we're going to be able to manage ourselves with an interface I will show you later. And so these condition variables are going to have three important operations. So one of the operations is going to be wait. And this operation, perhaps a bit non-intuitively, is going to take a condition variable and a lock. And what it's going to do is it's going to say, you're holding that lock, which is probably, hopefully, this lock over the shared data. And I want to unlock the lock and simultaneously add you to one of these queues of threads that are waiting. So when you do this, you add yourself to the queue of threads that are waiting, and you release the lock, so some other thread from the queue starts running. And hopefully, it's going to eventually make some whatever you're waiting for happen. But that's why you're waiting. And this wait operation, eventually, we're going to finish whatever we're doing, and we're going to stop waiting. And what's going to happen is that at some point, someone that actually runs is going to say, oh, all these waiting threads, they're done. They can stop waiting. And it's going to use one of these other operations to indicate that. So the simplest one of these is the broadcast operation. So that says there's a bunch of threads which are waiting on this condition variable. All of them should run. And because all of them were holding the lock before they waited, what we're going to do is we're going to have them all just start waiting for the lock. So basically, the broadcast operation just says we're going to take all those waiting threads, move them from this separate queue onto the lock queue, so they can start running. Yeah?
Do the blue threads have a separate lock than the...
Question is, do the blue threads have a separate lock than the other threads? No. They were just blue because they were previously not waiting for the lock, but they were waiting for this condition variable to be, in this case, broadcast to. So an example usage might be that these threads were waiting for for stuff to be put on the buffer. Now there's stuff on the buffer, so now they're waiting for the lock for the buffer. And that's what we did with the broadcast operation. There's also a signal operation. And the signal operation chooses one thread from the queue. We don't specify how it's chosen. You would think it would be the first or the last one, but that's not required. And wakes it up, making it start waiting for the lock. So this would be more applicable to our producer-consumer example. So I added an item to the buffer, so I'm going to wake up a thread so it can use that item. Okay, so questions about what I have here? So these are our basic operations, and this is going to let us do everything we could do with semaphores, and our textbook would argue more intuitively. So let me give a simple example of usage doing basically our pthread join. And there's some weird things here. So here I have a finished variable. So rather than having the semaphore that holds whether we're finished or not, I have the shared data, which is are we finished or not, and I want to wait for that to become true. So what I do is I acquire the lock because that this is the data which we can only access after acquiring the lock. Remember? And I check if we're not finished yet. And if so, I want to wait. So I wait on this condition variable, so I add myself to that queue of waiting threads, waiting for us to be finished. And I make sure I release the lock while I'm doing that by telling cond wait, here's the lock I had, that's the lock you want me to release while I'm doing this. And I want to get back right before I finish. Then in our finish, we acquire the lock. We set finish to true, and we broadcast on the condition variable, which remember is going to make all those threads which were waiting now wait to acquire the lock. Then they're going to acquire the lock, and after they do, we're going to start keep running this loop. We're going to go back to the beginning of this loop, just find out, oh, yep, finish is true. Then we're going to unlock the lock again and return. Okay, so this is an example of usage. So, and we have this, this is the sort of normal pattern we have, that we acquire the lock, we check whether we need to wait at all. So unlike our pthread join, this is how we're keeping track of that. And unlike this, the join example I showed earlier, we can have as many threads as we want, wait for someone to finish with this pattern, without doing any extra work. You might say, why is there a loop? We'll explain that next time. That's where I'll finish up today.